Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Matthew Radcliffe, professor of philosophy at the University of York. His new book, Grief Worlds, A Study of Emotional Experience, is just out from the MIT Press. The grief we feel when someone close to us dies is characterized by a complex and profound experience of loss. But what is this experience? In Grief Worlds, Radcliffe articulates a common structure to grief experiences, even while emphasizing that each person's experience is highly individual. In his account, we live in experiential worlds structured by valued possibilities and anticipations that are integral to our identities as persons. And in grief, we experience a disruption or undermining of these networks of significant possibilities. His analysis draws on personal testimonies of grief experiences gathered in a public survey, along with philosophical work from the analytic and phenomenological traditions. Radcliffe also examines the bodily phenomenology of grief, the ways we transition to post-bereavement worlds, and the ways in which continuing bonds with the deceased and the pre-bereavement world can be adaptive. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Matthew. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello, Carrie.
I'm very excited to talk about Grief Worlds, A Study of Emotional Experience. Before we begin, let's get a bit of information about you. So how did you become a philosopher and how did you come to write this book?
Oh, how did I become a philosopher? Well, I think going back to when I was a teenager, I suppose, I'd got it into my head that I was going to be a medical doctor or a vet or something like that, but it didn't. I don't think I was genuinely interested. And what did strike me was that everything just seemed utterly strange and bewildering and peculiar, and things that people took for granted seemed sort of rather baffling. So I guess that drove me into philosophy. I did a first degree in philosophy and psychology at Durham University. And then I drifted into philosophy of science at Cambridge during my MPhil and PhD. And then after that, I took a rather staggering route driven by contingency rather than purpose and ended up working on a combination of phenomenology, philosophy of psychiatry, and I suppose interdisciplinary emotion theory. And that's kind of where I've settled ever since, really.
Well, this book certainly brings, you know, a lot of those things together, because it's the phenomenology of the grief process. I guess a good way to begin is to get an idea of what you consider to be grief, right? I mean, you a brief description would be, or definition would be, an emotional response to loss. But obviously there's a bit more to say about that. So what is your analysis of grief?
Well, yes, I suppose one of the first tasks might be to get to sort of clarify one's referent. So if I'm offering a phenomenological analysis of grief, what am I actually talking about? I mean, in fact, I don't want to be too prescriptive. I've been thinking about grief in the book primarily in relation to the death of a person. So we can think of it as a protracted emotional response to the death of a person one loves or cares about deeply. However, if you look at everyday discourse, the term grief is used in a more permissive way as well. So people will talk about grief over the breakup of a relationship, sometimes grief over the loss of a job. Also, maybe something we'll come to later, grief over things that never happened or never will be. So there's this more permissive use of grief where it's used to refer to a range of non-death losses and how we experience them. So what I tend to do is focus on bereavement and use grief, the term grief, principally to refer to that. But I also am entirely accepting of a more permissive conception of grief, which encompasses a wider range of losses. And the reason for that is I think there are a lot of structural similarities between bereavement experiences and other experiences of loss. Furthermore, I think by tending to focus specifically on bereavement when thinking about grief and loss, there's perhaps a tendency to eclipse some of these experiences or to understate their significance. So I'm open to both narrow and broader uses of the term grief.
Okay, good, good. Because one of the things you do later on in the book, which we will get to, is in reference to a survey that you took, that you undertook in 2020, 2021, where a number of the respondents reported feeling grief about not having had children, you know, childlessness, which, you know, is one of those interesting cases where there seems to be genuine grief, but it's not for something that got lost. Okay, I've mentioned the grief experience survey. Could you say a bit about that survey? Because there's quotes sprinkled throughout the book that come from that survey.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a technique that I first started using back in about 2009, 2010, I think, when I was working on the phenomenology of depression as part of a collaborative project. And we thought, well, rather than just relying on published sources, let's just see if we can ask people what it's like to be depressed and give them a series of questions addressing various different aspects of experience and invite them to give free text, open-ended responses. And back then we were really surprised that within the space of a couple of weeks, we got well over 100 responses. And these were incredibly detailed with these rich, insightful, nuanced descriptions of the experience of depression. And we were so overwhelmed by what we got so quickly, we just shut the survey down. And then spent a long time reflecting on these responses, and we learned a great deal from them. And so because of that, I've done this subsequently on a number of occasions. And I think probably the grief questionnaire was the most fruitful. We got 265 responses, again, in a fairly short period. And again, what really strikes me is just how eloquently people describe these, you know, extraordinarily painful and for many people sort of unusual and unsettling aspects of experience. So we've got a range of testimonies which address various aspects of grief. We ask people, you know, does the world seem different during grief? How does your body feel? Do you continue to relate to the person who's died? And so on. I think it was 21 questions in total. And so we got all these responses and we've used them to inform our philosophical thinking. We've also made them publicly available in two different formats, one that is tailored for use by other researchers and one which is for the general public to explore their own and others' experiences of grief by engaging with these responses. So, I mean, I don't really think of them as data in the context of phenomenological inquiry. It's more These are testimonies that I interpret that sort of challenge certain philosophical assumptions I might make, or illustrate various points, or identify something where it's important to make distinctions, perhaps, that aren't ordinarily made. And sometimes we're faced with experiences that are just challenging to understand at all. But one of the things that strikes me is often you don't have to do a lot of interpretive work. You can set out a phenomenological position, and you find that sometimes people are describing things in fairly similar terms. And an emphasis in my own work that I find time and time again in these studies of experiential disturbance, if you like, people emphasize changes and disruptions in the experience of possibility, and a profound sense of the loss of possibilities. And I found that stretching all the way from these surveys on depression through to grief, despite various important differences in the kinds of experience people are describing.
Hmm. So one of the things that structures your analysis of the phenomenology or the experience of grief is this idea that there's a contradiction, or at least some sort of tension in these experiences, and you develop what you call a two-sided view of grief, of the phenomenology, I say, where it's, you know, it's both the individual and also the world. I mean, that's kind of where I take it your title, the title Grief Worlds, comes from this aspect. Could you explain that general perspective?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, another aspect of the title Grief Worlds is the plural, where I'm very hesitant about making any kind of sort of firm generalizations about grief. So I would stress that this one thing I just keep finding is this tremendous variety and also a great deal of complexity that often passes unnoticed. But I think a structure that is common to probably all of those experiences that we might refer to as profound grief or as involving a profound sense of loss is what I call this two-sided structure. And it applies not just to grief, but to a range of emotional episodes and processes. So there are two steps, really. One is to say that an emotion involves experiencing something as significant, as mattering in one or another way, relative to what you might call a value system, a web of commitments, cares, concerns, projects, and goals, which is coherent to varying degrees. So we experience something as significant in the light, if you like, of our values, broadly construed. But the other aspect of this is something can appear significant where its significance involves the potential or actual undermining of that value system. So it matters, and how it matters implies, the way in which it matters implies the disruption of the very value system relative to which it matters. So you have this kind of tension and instability, and also a dynamic structure as one negotiates the significance of something relative to a changing value system. But the other step, and this is sort of where it relates to phenomenology and more specifically themes in the phenomenological tradition, is that a lot of what I've just referred to as our value system takes the form of a presupposed experiential world. It's a context that we inhabit, forged by habitual practices and expectations, which constitute ways of experiencing things, patterns of thought and patterns of activity. And I offer a more specific analysis in terms of the possibilities that our surroundings offer. So even now, as I'm just sitting in this room talking with you via a microphone, things appear immediately pre-reflectively significant in various different ways. The microphone in front of me, my distant interlocutor who I'm aware of through the names on the screen and so on, the pile of papers surrounding me, the glass of water, all of this knits together as a sort of fairly coherent network of significance. So the world is imbued with possibilities that reflect our values. And what happens in grief over a period of time is you have something that appears significant within the context of a world, and yet it appears significant in a way that undermines the very world in which it appears. So there's this tension that's characteristic of certain kinds of emotional intentionality. In various different ways, emotion can involve experiencing something in a way that, if you like, pulls the rug out from under your feet. And this isn't something that you comprehend or recognize instantly. It can be something that plays out over a prolonged period of time and involve not just a singular experience of tension, but a range of different tensions and incongruities and a sort of sense of disorientation.
I'm sure this has happened and probably was reported in the survey. But this sense of significance that gets undermined, or the value system that gets undermined, is there aspect of revelation or self-knowledge or something where you don't know what the value system is until the rug gets pulled out, so to speak?
Yes. I mean, somebody else who's been writing on grief recently is Michael Cholbi in Edinburgh, and he's placed more emphasis on self-knowledge than I have. But I think, yes, that there can be this sense of revelation. And this is something that's common to various forms of emotional experience and also to certain kinds of phenomenological inquiry. And also to phenomenological inquiry. It's the what one recognizes sometimes the contingency of what was previously taken for granted. So in an extreme case, what you just took as given as your world, the background of your life, something that's integral to your sense of identity, and one sense of identity is suddenly gone. And people talk about their world being shattered, no longer being the same person, finding themselves utterly lost and bewildered. And so it's described in various ways, and also it happens in various different ways. So there can be this sudden sense of things being shattered, but in fact, this can play out over time in a number of different ways.
Right. Well, I mean, so I guess, you know, I'm thinking of cases where, you talk about the anticipatory structure of a life, right? There's certain, you know, you're embedded in a certain experiential world, and this is why the experience of losing, say, a spouse or something like that, I mean, is that person is playing a particular role, and then of course the loss of that person, you know, disrupts all those, you know, anticipated experiences with that person who is no longer alive. But I'm thinking also of cases where it isn't an explicit, obvious element in one's life at all, and something happens, may not even recognize, right, why you might be feeling a little bit disrupted.
So you're not thinking specifically of bereavement now, are you, but more generally?
Maybe not. Or maybe just a sense that, what I'm feeling is bereavement, because now I recognize that there was this thing that was part of my life, but I didn't really recognize it as such.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think you're right. And one thing I emphasize is that, you know, that there are very different aspects to grief. So grief is, of course, you know, about the death of the person. It's not just about what happened to me. It's about what they've lost as well. But when we're thinking about the what's happened to me aspect, I mean, it's actually quite difficult to individuate the experience of grief or loss, because when a person dies, so many other things are lost that might not seem to relate to that person, but in fact do. So perhaps, you know, all these things we did together are not the same, but it was always us who met with our friends, and this is no longer possible. So there are all these losses, many of which won't be anticipated. And also many of which won't be recognised by other people. So the death of a person is recognised, of course, through funerals, condolences, all sorts of rituals and practices and narratives. But there's so much other stuff surrounding bereavement that passes by silently. And, you know, in extreme cases, maybe people struggle to articulate this. There's a sense of loss or disorientation, and they can't really pin it down. But I do think this applies much more generally. There are all sorts of forms of loss that are under-theorized, under-recognized, difficult to articulate. One might sense that something is wrong, and then perhaps over a period of time it crystallizes, and one comes to the recognition that, yes, this is integral to my grief. This is part of my grief, or this is a form of grief. And I think we often are surprised by the context in which we experience grief or loss. And this is getting sidetracked a little bit, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot. I think we're really bad, as others have remarked, at anticipating how we will feel on some future occasion in light of certain events. So one example would just be, you know, I always commit to too many papers to write or too many conference presentations. I think I'll be fine. And then a year later, I'm thinking, why the heck did I say that? What on earth was I thinking? So you can't sort of put yourself in the position of your future self. And I think that's partly because so much of our experience is constituted by what we take to be this presupposed world, rather than something integral to our own psychology. So suppose you're thinking, oh, you know, should I break up with this person? Should I move to this new place? You might imagine everything and think, yeah, well, that's going to be all right. And then you find it's not. And there's this sense of loss. And it concerns something you haven't factored in because you took it for granted for the world, as if this world could somehow be exported as well. And of course it can't. And I think there are a range of circumstances where we are surprised by loss, bewildered by loss. So, I mean, as you can see, I could probably go on forever there. And I just think there's so much to say on this topic about the ways in which we anticipate and then experience loss.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, so this was a sense I got from the book, you know, because of your, you know, kind of permissive, you know, you weren't really interested in, you know, defining grief. I mean, it was more just the phenomenology that you're exploring. But again, the way you kind of get it, you know, describe the experiences, you know, not so much having an object, but as a loss of certain, you know, possibilities, the connection with loss of possibilities made me think, you know, is this really a phenomenology of loss rather than of grief as such? Or, you know, do we just mean by grief? We don't want to mean grief as loss. I mean, I don't think that seems very too broad.
And I think
your analysis seems to have greater scope than grief.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm slightly worried about the fact that both of these terms slide around. So we can refer to grief, in a specific way, where grief is a response to an emotional response to a death. But then we can think of grief as referring to wider experiences of loss. But there are also various experiences of loss that we don't talk of usually in terms of grief. The book is focused specifically on grief over the death of a person. And I think what's distinctive there is a sense of, you know, of the irrevocable absence of another person, the loss of their possibilities and our possibilities rather than just our own. But of course, the boundaries are never going to be clear cut. So, you know, there are really difficult cases such as pregnancy loss, where some people will refer to it as a bereavement and others will resist that language. So there are all sorts of cases where it's not clear whether what we're calling grief is about a bereavement or principally about a bereavement. So I do think that there is something that there is something to be said for focusing on bereavement grief, and that's what I do. But at the same time, I acknowledge that if we think of grief in a broader sense as well, as a sort of loss of possibilities that are integral to who one is as a person, then this applies much more widely as well. And there are important similarities between bereavement and other forms of loss. And I also think it illuminates our understanding of bereavement experiences if we also think of grief or loss in this broader sense, because bereavement grief isn't just about the death of a person. It's about the loss of so much that involves or implicates that person in one or another way.
Yeah. So, yeah, to, you know, to bring us kind of back to the structure of the book itself, you talk about anticipatory structures. You mentioned this before, but could you go into that a bit more about the anticipatory structures in a life or of experience, and then the relation of grief to these anticipatory structures?
Yes, I mean, my work for a number of years has sort of drawn on and sought to develop themes in the phenomenological tradition. I sort of started off by writing about Heidegger quite a lot, but I've gone off Heidegger for I don't quite know why. I think maybe after a while you just develop some kind of allergic reaction, I'm not sure. But I tend still to draw a lot on sort of the combination of Husserl and Merleau-Ponty. And a common theme is what we might call the horizontal structure of experience, which is the idea that pre-reflective experience, regardless of whether or not we want to call this perceptual, involves not just encountering what is right here, right now, but rather there's always this structured system of possibilities, and these involve perceptual possibilities. So when I see this stapler in front of me, I can pick it up as I am now, I can bang it on the desk and disrupt this recording. There are all these various possibilities involving the thing that we're open to in this pre-reflective immediate way. So my visual perception of the stapler in front of me incorporates possibilities for perception in other modalities, and also for manipulating it in various ways in order to disclose certain perceivable properties. But then there are all sorts of practical possibilities as well. So I broaden this analysis to emphasize how things appear significant in various ways. And the next move is crucial, which is to emphasize that many possibilities that we experience take the form of anticipation. We anticipate things unfolding in certain ways as things happen, as others do things, and as we ourselves act upon the world. And ordinarily, this takes the form of, if you like, anticipation followed by fulfillment. It's not that we anticipate exactly what's going to happen. There's a degree of indeterminacy or openness. So, for example, if I hear a car driving past now, that's unsurprising. That's consistent with this broad anticipatory structure. Whereas if I hear an elephant making a noise on the street outside the house, that's going to appear immediately incongruous or surprising. So we could say for the most part, things unfold in line with anticipation, albeit indeterminate anticipation. And yet in the context of this broad, cohesive, unfolding pattern of anticipation, there are various localized experiences that we might describe in terms of negation, anomaly, surprise, and sometimes doubt, ambiguity, and a different kind of uncertainty. So what we find in both Husserl and Merleau-Ponty is the idea that our sense of belonging to a world presupposes this underlying pattern, this unfolding dynamic style of experience. And what I suggest is that, amongst other things, bereavement disrupts this whole structure. It disrupts established patterns of anticipation in ways that are experienced in terms of strangeness, indeterminacy, and various tensions.
So you mentioned you know, Husserl and Merleau-Ponty and you know, the phenomenology of perception that they talk about as well. But also the idea of the body, the involvement of the body and the bodily phenomenology of grief. Could you explain that element of the phenomenology of grief? And there's also, you also draw a very interesting connection to phantom limb syndrome, when there's a loss of a limb and yet people continue in some ways to experience having the limb. So could you say a bit about this, the bodily aspect of the phenomenology of grief?
Yeah, there's quite a lot to say here. So if I go on too long, just interrupt me and tell me to be quiet. But for a number of years, I've tried to challenge distinctions between, if you like, the bodily aspects of emotion and the world-directed intentionality of emotion. And in short, the way I do that, which is, I think, fairly consistent with themes in the work of Merleau-Ponty and to some extent Husserl, is to suggest that our experiences of possibilities are inextricable from the feeling body. It's through various bodily tendencies that possibilities appear in our surroundings. The body, if you like, is an organ of perception rather than just an object of perceptual experience. And something I do throughout the book is emphasize that grief is both bodily and, if you like, richly cognitive. But really, when we're talking about the bodily and the cognitive aspects, we're talking about the same thing. We need to really break down those distinctions to understand grief. So in the third chapter, I emphasize the bodily aspects. And then in the fourth chapter, I suggest that this can at the same time be construed as cognitive. Indeed, it even encompasses linguistic thought. The two are inextricable. But when it comes to the body, one of the things I do is focus on this comparison between grief and loss of a limb. So, you know, in everyday discourse, it's often said that grief is like, you know, bereavement is like losing a part of oneself. You know, it's like losing an arm or a leg. I really don't know how to explain it, but it is as if a part of me has been amputated. It really is as if part of me is missing. And it just sounds that, you know, when people really emphasize this, it sounds as if there's a lot more to it than just some kind of analogy that's employed to emphasize how important a person was. And people also describe certain experiences in grief as akin to a phantom limb. You know, it's as if they're still there now. It's as if they're present and yet absent. So what I do is say, okay, let's explore both of these experiences in as much detail as we can. Ask to what extent do we find commonalities? And if there are indeed common structures to these experiences, why might that be the case? And I start off again by turning to Merleau-Ponty, who has some passages where he compares grief to phantom limbs. And what he suggests in both cases is that something integral to habitual patterns of expectation is absent, and yet those patterns remain. So you can look and see that your arm has gone, and yet the world still appears as it would if you had that arm. It still offers all the same practical possibilities. So you have this non-localized sense of absence, presence, which is compatible with your, if you like, propositional recognition of absence. Now, one thing I say is that phantom limbs, in fact, are quite heterogeneous, and there's a lot more to be said about them. And phantom limbs don't just involve retaining possibilities associated with the absent limb. There are also quite vivid image-like experiences of various kinds. Then again, we might say the same about grief. There are various different aspects of grief we could compare to a phantom limb. But let's just focus on this retention of possibilities in the face of what Merleau-Ponty calls mutilation. We can see, I think, fairly clearly that something analogous does indeed apply in the case of bereavement. In certain kinds of interpersonal relationship, another person may be implicated in one's practice to a huge extent, perhaps in a way that is comparable to one's own limbs. Just as one's body contributes to the possibilities offered by the world, so does the relationship. It is only in light of the relationship that we can do this, that this appears a possibility, that we can carry on in this way, that our environment offers us this rather than that. So you can see that there's a structural analogy here. But furthermore, the two are entangled. One's body doesn't contribute to experience as a certain component, and then other people come in as another component, both contributing in separable ways to the possibilities on offer. Rather, it's the inextricable combination of the two that determines the possibilities available to us. So our bodily capacities, our projects and our relationships with others upon which our projects and capacities depend, all of these are interdependent. So we might say that the death of a person can transform one's world in a way that really is similar to the loss of a part of one's body, and also inextricable from the contribution of one's body. So, you know, it really does feel as if one's body is different, that one has lost some ability. So the analogy with a phantom limb, I think, turns out to be very, very close indeed in the end, closer than many people have taken it to be.
Have you looked at all into the neuroscience of grief? I mean, there's certainly been quite a bit of that in terms of phantom limb and, you know, various ways in which, you know, the brain might have been structured to, you know, initiate movement in a particular limb, that preparatory, you know, sort of neural signaling is still there, even though the arm itself is not there, or something like that. Have you looked at all into any of the possible, you know, neural components or aspects of the grief experience?
Not really, no. And I'm not sure how much we would gain by doing so, at least where understanding the phenomenology of grief is concerned. But I mean, what I did do is look at some of the literature on the neuroscience of phantom limbs and other findings that are relevant to the analogy with grief. So I what you'll find is, of course, there are going to be anatomical differences. So you can say quite clearly the anatomical effects of a bereavement are going to be quite different from that of losing an arm. At the same time, there are, you know, functional commonalities, which are sort of backed up by some of the, you know, certain scientific findings. So I looked at some of this literature on perceptions of salience and significance and how they're affected by the presence of other people. How even if you don't know the people you're with, whether something appears more or less appealing. You know, again, in a sort of pre-reflective immediate way, can depend upon other people in your vicinity, whether they're looking at it, whether they're smiling and so on. So it does seem that there's some quite good evidence to the effect that other people, aren't just objects in our environment. They regulate in dynamic ways the salience and significance of our surroundings. And then if you add to that the effects of being in a long-term relationship with someone, you know, rather than just bumping into a stranger and having them regulate your perceptions of significance, I think there's quite a lot to be said there. So I think that there's you're going to find plenty of evidence to back up claims for sort of functional commonalities. There might well be all sorts of interesting things to say about the neuroscience of grief, and I have to confess I haven't, you know, I haven't explored the literature as far as one might. Then again, it could be that there's just nothing there.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there is a neuroscience of grief.
I think one of the methodological problems with this is that grief isn't an episodic emotion that you can pin down. You can't put somebody in a scanner and look at areas of brain activation associated with feelings of grief. As I've suggested and as many others maintain, grief is better construed as a temporally extended process, which may be unified in certain ways, but all the same encompasses a range of different forms of emotional experience, thought process, and activity. So it would be very difficult to pin down any specific neurobiological correlate of grief. There seems to be a perhaps intractable methodological problem here when we're talking about grief per se. And then if we talk about components of grief, well, they're equally components of something else. So it's not quite clear how one should proceed here or what kinds of questions one can legitimately ask.
Yeah. Well, at least certainly not with a scanner.
No, that's not good. That's it.
Yeah. So moving from, so you have this, disruptions in our experience of possibility and, anticipations that end up not getting fulfilled in a rather sharp way. How do we go from that stage to the new world, I suppose, the post-grief or post-bereavement world? What does that sort of transition consist in?
I don't think it consists in anything singular, and I think it can happen in various different ways. And there are also various different endpoints. I'm also increasingly wary of just thinking of the sort of post-bereavement world in terms of some complete adjustment, a reconstruction of the world such that it is now entirely coherent with the death of a person. So, one thing I'm thinking about a lot now is, and something philosophers haven't actually addressed, to my knowledge, the ways in which people talk of being haunted in various ways by losses. Something continues to remain in the background. Something isn't fully accommodated. But with that in mind, I think we need to address the distinctively personal aspects of grief and also the world of grief. So we can say that the world of grief shifts over time through this sort of protracted process where one is confronted with these experiences of absence and negation and anomaly and practical expectations and practices come to be revised over time. So there's this temporal process of accommodating things. First of all, a system of practices may be retained in a way that is utterly at odds with the fact of the death. So this is often described in terms of the death seeming impossible, inconceivable, utterly true. I know beyond any doubt that they've died, and yet it seems unfathomable because my world stays in place. And over time, in various ways, the world shifts. And this is something that may be enhanced or disrupted through one's own activities. Also, it's important to point out that it's massively scaffolded by interpersonal and social environments. It depends on what you do with other people and on the ability to engage with the wider social world. So what we saw in the pandemic were profound disruptions of people's grief experiences, which are plausibly associated with the denial of various interpersonal and social opportunities due to social restrictions. And this interfered in various ways with this process of transforming one's world. But of course, it's not enough just to talk about one's world as if someone's death simply affects one's own system of practices and so on. One also, grief is directed at them. It is resolutely interpersonal. It is about that person. And the interpersonal aspects of grief play out alongside this. As Peter Goldie pointed out in some of his last published works, grief involves this kind of narrative structure where you look back at your memories of that person, you recognise the significance those memories had for you. And now, at the same time, there's a sense that things are different now. Those memories seem different. Those memories aren't significant. They don't point in the same way to the future. They don't relate to one's life in the same way now. So one also has to negotiate the loss of an interpersonal relationship. And as the continuing bonds literature has pointed out, it's not simply about letting go of a person or finally recognizing the irrevocable loss of that person. The shift in worlds is accompanied by and indissociable from how one navigates the how one navigates this loss, and how one continues to relate to that person, how one's memories are reconfigured, the significance of objects and how one rearranges those objects, whether and in what way one feels an enduring sense of connection. One might even talk to them. People talk about a sense of receiving messages in various ways, an ambiguous, sometimes tension-riddled sense of their continuing presence. And in an almost paradoxical way, the continuing presence of the person who's died can be integral to one's ability to navigate their death, to negotiate what has happened. So on the one hand, you recognize that they've died, and on the other hand, there may be this enduring sense of what it's like to be with them. One may continue to experience the possibilities offered by situations somehow in light of that relationship. So there's this really, really complicated mixture of presence and absence involving aspects of one's world and of one's relationship with that person. And it's terribly difficult to make generalizations here, but I think what you can do is identify structural features of experience and come to understand those in ways that might help to illuminate any particular case.
So, yeah, I mean, there's always a sense in which, sometimes one is urged to, move on, right? As they say, and sometimes, I mean, you discuss times when continuing is adaptive, and that seems to me what you were just describing, but also maladaptive, and where moving on, again, might be adaptive or maladaptive. This is complicated. It's hard to generalize, but is there anything general you might say about, when continuing might be more adaptive, and when it might be maladaptive?
I suppose the first thing to point out is I've come to think that the contrast that is often drawn between retaining a continuing bond, some sense of connection with the person who's died, and letting go and moving on, that's quite misleading. And if you look at some of the past literature, sort of Bowlby and even Freud, that's supposed to be advocating the view that grief involves letting go and moving on, it can be interpreted plausibly in terms of moving on from a certain life structure or world or system of values that implicates the deceased to one that doesn't. And that's actually compatible with retaining a continuing bond. You can reorganize your world and your habits, but there can still be a place for the person, a continuing relationship with that person, or a sense of connection at least, in one's life. But then when it comes to, we can still ask, when is a sense of connection pathological or inappropriate in some other way? And when is it not? And I suppose we could say, what kinds of connection are appropriate or inappropriate? And I'm really wary of making any kind of generalization here, partly because a kind of bond that is appropriate for one person, according to one or another kind of norm, we can appeal to various different norms here. We can talk about sort of practical norms, moral norms, epistemic norms, medical norms. A kind of bond that might be appropriate to one person in relation to some kind of norm, may apply quite differently in the life of somebody else. It's so sort of contextualized and depends upon people and their circumstances. What I try and do later on is just say that there are certain distinctive forms of grief that others have labelled pathological, and we can describe them in contrast to forms of grief that are labelled as typical. And these are forms of grief that involve some combination of three different things. One retains the past world in the face of its impossibility. So you might think of this in terms of a kind of denial, where it's not that you actively believe a proposition that you somehow know to be untrue, but convince yourself somehow that it remains the case. Rather, the denial would consist in preserving a world that is no longer sustainable, a world that implicates the person. On the other hand, you could think of a form of grief where one doesn't go through the work of revising one's world, but just sort of leaps away from it. And it continues to bubble up in the background, resulting in sort of, you know, feelings of emotional pain that don't diminish over time. And you can actually think of those two as sort of compatible in various scenarios. But there's something else as well that I think is sometimes missed that I refer to as the place between worlds. So what bereavement can involve and other forms of loss, it involves the disruption and loss of all these networks of norms that shape one's activities and thoughts, norms that are ordinarily experienced as embedded in one's surroundings. You don't have to think about it. You just inhabit a world where you're guided in these various ways. So what people sometimes describe following a bereavement is the sense of being lost or disorientated, where it's not just that you don't know which path to follow anymore. Things don't make sense in a way. Things don't have their place anymore. It's as if the world previously constituted a kind of map with signposts all over the place and it's all gone. I mean, in the most profound scenario, there's no fact of the matter as to what comes next. It almost reminds me of some of Wittgenstein's stuff on rule following. Sort of 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, 16, 10, no fact of the matter.
Right.
Sort of, you know, the Kripke Wittgenstein paradox come alive.
Right.
And I think this is inevitable to some degree following really, really disruptive bereavements. But also people can end up in this scenario where you can't escape the disorientation. There's not enough structure left to rebuild a world. And I think some forms of grief experience are like this. The world remains shattered in a way that prevents its being rebuilt. And we can think a lot here about the interpersonal and social dimensions of regulation again. So whether or not one ends up lost depends an awful lot on other people and whether one takes it that one can still rely on other people. And I think when grief involves an all-pervasive loss of interpersonal trust, this often involves this enduring sense of disorientation that one can't recover from. And again, this is relevant when we think of the pandemic, because many people grieved in the context of a wider sense of loss and disorientation. So if you like, you know, the structure required to situate the fact of the bereavement in the context of a world, that structure was peculiarly lacking. And what a lot of people are describing are these forms of prolonged grief that are variously described as the inability to grieve, or in contrast as a grief without end. But again, I would emphasize, I stray away from making generalizations along the lines of X is pathological, Y is typical. Instead, the most I do is say, here are some things that people take to be pathological, and here's an analysis of these kinds of grief, which shows how they differ from other forms of grief that are taken to be typical. But I tend to be wary of sort of endorsing sort of medicalized conceptions.
Right. Well, there's a number of things you mentioned there that I want to pick up on. So one, you mentioned the COVID-19, you know, pandemic. Could you say a bit more about how your analysis kind of intersects with the, and I don't mean just the grief, you know, of losing a particular person in the pandemic, right? Somebody who you know, got COVID and died rather suddenly. But the sort of disorientation that people felt who did not perhaps lose a particular member of their family, but just the complete disorientation of the whole world, really.
Yes, I mean, when I started the collaborative project that this my book Grief World is part of, I mean, we began this study in January 2020, having received funding for a 4-year project from the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. And what we didn't really see coming were, I don't think anyone really saw it coming.
No.
It's
like two months later, yeah.
Extraordinarily radical restrictions. So when we did the grief experience survey, this was while people were under lockdown in the UK, and lots of people referred to the pandemic in describing their experiences of grief. And I was also fortunate to be involved in another project, which was led by Tom Froese at the University of Okinawa in Japan. And this involved two pandemic experience surveys, which sought to explore people's wider experiences during these extraordinary times where they were under all sorts of different kinds of social restrictions, depending on their country, the countries or states they were living in, and what time in the pandemic this was. And so we received lots of testimonies through both surveys, which described disruptive forms of bereavement grief, some relating to COVID deaths and others to non-COVID deaths. What people also described was this wider sense of loss and disorientation. And this is one of the things that has got me very interested in sort of loss construed more generally, and to the extent that it may be the subject matter of my next big project. But I think we're all of us are only just beginning to get to grips with this, maybe theoretically and in the context of our own lives. What people describe was a sense of loss or grief relating to particular activities or opportunities. But what's perhaps more interesting and philosophically challenging are these cases where people just refer to a loss of possibilities, a loss of time, a loss of the ability to sustain who one was or to become something or someone that was central to their lives, a tremendous grief over the loss of possibilities for others. And, you know, my own work over a number of years has emphasized the phenomenology of possibility above all else. And I think this emphasis is really conducive to the interpretation of many people's experiences. Often there's almost inchoate, wide-ranging sense of lost possibilities. So my project colleagues, Louise Richardson and Becky Miller, have written an article on non-death losses in the pandemic just recently. And they make the very good point that a lot of this seems trivial. You know, the sense of grief over not going to the pub sounds just downright insulting in the context of the terrible tragedies that so many have suffered. And yet these are sometimes just sort of very specific, sort of concrete ways of articulating something more general. So you just see all these tiny little tips of a whacking great iceberg. So it's not just that I can't go to the bingo hall or I can't go and chat with my friend while I'm walking the dog or sit in the cafe or get on the train to work and so on. All of this together is integral to this much wider loss of possibilities. And that's what a lot of people describe in many different ways. And again, it's terribly difficult to generalize because the pandemic meant many different things to different people and affected people in so many different ways. So I was looking at one survey response yesterday where someone just wrote, I don't feel any sense of loss. I'm stinking rich and I'm going to make even more money out of this scare fest. So that is in contrast to what many other people experienced. And it's not restricted to particular age groups either. You know, many older people report, you know, the loss of time that can't be recovered, vital interpersonal opportunities as they approach the end of their own lives, whereas younger people also are referring to these moments that can never be recovered. And I don't know how discussion of this will proceed. You know, for many people, it just seems to be like waking up from a bad dream, and maybe it will just recede into the past. So I don't know the extent to which these experiences will be theorized or indeed should be theorized. Is there something here that people need to learn how to talk about? Is it something that people need to be able to narrate and somehow move on from? Or is it not? Would that just be kind of overdoing it a bit and sensationalizing it? But whatever the case, I'm pretty sure there's some philosophical work to be done here, specifically on the sense of loss, and also something related to this, which is what you might call the sense of being lost, this odd form of disorientation or being adrift that many experienced.
Mm. Right. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, again, so many different, you know, I was thinking about you mentioned the the fact that all of these experiences are massively scaffolded by our social environments. And you had mentioned, you know, this idea that the fact that you maybe couldn't go to the pub, you know, some think of that as trivial or insulting, but of course, that kind of highlights the whole fact of the embedded, the social environment in which, in a way, you're permitted to experience grief, you know, in some way that is not, you know, purely private, you know, and I mean, this is a whole, in a way, a whole nother, aspect that, we haven't explored, but, you know, it's like, you know, grieving for one's lost, you know, longtime spouse is a socially acceptable loss. Loss of other aspects of one's environment, which is, you know, might be equally part of one's world, are not. And interesting to, you know, the way that the social expectations impinge on one's ability to both experience it and transition away from it, just seems to be like something, yeah, that also requires some sort of exploration.
Yeah, there's a great deal to be said here. So we can say in the case of bereavement grief, regardless of how sort of insensitive or superficial people's treatment of it may sometimes be, it's something that is socially acknowledged. It is something that is that involves various practices and rituals and forms of interaction where people can get together. And we might say the awkwardness of grief is mitigated by certain rituals and expectations which allow people to interact in these very structured environments, despite dealing with something so profoundly disruptive of interpersonal relationships. And also, you just look at our wider culture, it's very difficult to find a film in which someone doesn't die and someone else doesn't grieve. And there are all these literary narratives and autobiographical narratives of bereavement. And yet there are many other forms of loss that aren't embedded in our practices in these ways and aren't acknowledged. And I think quite a helpful term here is coined by Kenneth Docker. This is some disenfranchised grief or disenfranchised loss, where we need to sort of tease apart various connotations of that. But we can think of it in terms of unsanctioned, unacknowledged loss, loss that may even be actively sort of excluded or stigmatized. And what really brought this home to us was just going back to our grief survey. So it was specifically on bereavement grief. But I think if memory serves, it was tweeted by somebody who heads an organization called Gateway Women, which is a support group for childless women who experience a profound sense of grief or loss. And around 30 of these women responded to the survey and described grief not over bereavement, but over childlessness. Now, one has to be careful here because childlessness can occur in various circumstances, some of which may involve bereavement or may be described in terms of bereavement by some or not others. But what really struck us was that these people were describing grief over childlessness per se. You know, that was an object of grief or the principal object of grief. And it was very much not about a historical event or even a sequence of historical events. It was about the loss of a possibility that was central to one's life, to one's sense of who one was in relation to others. People talked about the loss of the ability to become someone, the loss of an identity, the inability to become the person that they took themselves to be, to sustain that person. But what they also describe is just the widespread lack of acknowledgement of this as a form of grief, the way in which people will trivialize it or see it as superficial and expect people to move on. It's like, oh, well, you can try again.
Or adopt.
Yeah. And people said, you know, that often people will say, you know, talk about adopting. One person said, you know, that they'll refer to adoption as if you're popping to the supermarket to buy something. And they don't recognize the sheer complexities of the situation and that, you know, it really isn't something that can involve a simple solution in that way. So that involves a case where, if you like, you know, at least a sort of predicament is acknowledged, but the depth of loss or grief that can be associated with it is not. And arguably, this applies to a range of other circumstances as well. You know, we've been thinking recently about aging as well, and the sense of loss associated with aging, and whether to what extent that is acknowledged and should be acknowledged. One might even think of how we should think of human life as a whole. You know, is loss ubiquitous in human life in ways that are often sort of not acknowledged or articulated? Does living, even a fulfilled life, inevitably entail this sort of comet's trail of loss that continues to haunt us? It's challenging to conceptualize a lot of this, and I'm still not quite sure how we should go about doing so.
Well, that brings us, I think, to the end of our conversation anyway, although certainly not a conversation in general over the experiences of grief. So you mentioned before what you're working on now. What is your project at the moment? Sounds like you're following up this book, or the work that went into this book with further explorations in the same vein. Could you say a bit about what you're doing now?
To be honest, I've spent a few months, well, maybe more than a few months, with a post-book feeling of being lost, which I don't think it's that uncommon. I've heard other philosophers say that they just feel miserable and apathetic having completed a book. However, I suspect that the next project I'll be involved in will be it's likely to be collaborative again, and will hopefully involve my current colleague, Louise Richardson, and various others. And I think what we will do is explore losses more generally. You talked earlier about how we define grief. Whether and how we define loss, or regard it as a univocal notion, I think is even more challenging. And two of the things we're thinking of doing are focusing on how loss relates to the sense of home, belonging, and even a sort of primitive sense of certainty. The other thing we're thinking of looking at is using the example of loss to explore the long-term dynamic structure of emotion experience, which has been neglected due to a widespread emphasis on brief emotional episodes and the acknowledgement, in addition to that, of only sort of longer-term constant moods. But a lot of the time, people don't describe their emotional experiences, at least the important ones, in terms of this established category rather than another. Describing the phenomenology of emotion isn't really an exercise in static labelling. Rather, people emphasise various dynamic qualities. And also, what really interests us, these kind of longer-term patterns. So four things we're hoping to look at are the experience of something sinking in over time, that's been neglected. Also, what it is for something to dawn emotionally. And that's not quite the same as sinking in, at least not in all contexts, because something can dawn on us and then take time to sink in. And in relation to this, we also want to look at the possibilities for avoidance and denial. But the other thing that I'm increasingly taken by is this notion of emotional haunting. People talk about this all the time, and I don't think philosophers have done it at all. What is it to be haunted by something? And in how many different ways are we haunted?
Very good. Well, we are out of time for the interview, but all of that sounds very interesting. And I, for one, look forward to seeing more work along these veins. But
thank you very much.
Yeah. So thank you again for agreeing to talk with New Books in Philosophy. And I wish you all the best with the work you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, you too. Thank you very much for the conversation.
You've been listening to an interview with Matthew Ratcliffe, Professor of Philosophy at the University of York. We've been talking about his new book, Grief Worlds, A Study of Emotional Experience, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.